You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everybody. My name is Whitney Neggebauer, and today is January 23rd, 2017. Today, a little bit later on, we will be joined by Don Noren of NOAA, Northwest Fisheries Science Center, and she is going to be telling us about her work on captive killer whales and how that information can help save endangered southern resident killer whales. Before then, I want to send out a few reminders. This weekend, January 28th, we are having a helping out event at Idlewood Park, and this is in conjunction with Green Redmond. One of our volunteers, Lori Gogic, is coordinating this event. She does a lot of great work around Puget Sound, helping salmon, and of course, she's really into killer whales and all whales. And so I hope that you all can join us. Idlewood Creek once supported a lot of salmon. Nowadays, we see kokanee, which are sort of like cousins of sockeye salmon. Go on Facebook or on our website. We have an event page up there, and you can learn more about the site. I also posted on the Facebook event some old photos of the park, which used to be a resort, and they had this giant water slide that we never ever could have in this day and age. Other things to be looking out for: NOAA just released their 5-year update about endangered southern resident killer whales, and I encourage you all to go take a look at it. We've posted it on our Facebook page, and you can also just Google it and find it. It's quite lengthy, but it's a great way to just stay on top of what's happening. And spoiler alert, they are still endangered, and there's a lot more work to be done. NOAA also is taking comments on a whale protection zone, and comments for that are due April 13th, 2017. This was something that was proposed in the past. However, this whale protection zone or no-go zone was left out of the regulations, and instead NOAA went with a 200-yard approach rule. And from my understanding, they are still studying how effective that 200-yard approach rule is in minimizing sound disturbance to foraging killer whales. More about that with Don Noren later on. Lastly, the comments for the Columbia River System Operations Environmental Impact Statement are due February 7th. This is the comment deadline that you're hearing everyone talk about, where their whale advocates are telling people that you would want to encourage them to look at the option of breaching the four lower Snake River dams. We are now joined by Don Noren. She is a physiological ecologist whose primary research interests include energetics and metabolism, assessment of body condition, diving physiology, and anthropogenic impacts. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
And I wanted to talk to you about some of your recent research and upcoming research that you're doing with SeaWorld, studying how toxins are moved from mama to calf. How did this research come about?
Well, one of the risk factors for the southern resident killer whales is their high contaminant loads, in particular the persistent organic pollutants that include PCBs, DDTs, PBDEs. And a few years ago, there was a student, master's student, Teresa Mongelo, who wrote a paper and did her master's thesis on modeling future contaminant loads in the killer whales based on the biopsy samples we have, the current loads, and what is known about transfer. And actually, it turns out there's not a lot known about transfer from females to calves during gestation when they have them in the womb, as well as during lactation through the milk. And so that kind of was a black box. And in order to really fully be able to predict what kind of future contaminant loads they would have based on current loads, and if you decided to ban a contaminant, for instance, that is one of the needed little numbers that you need to have. So I thought, you know, it'd be really important to try to quantify that. And really, that kind of study of quantifying the transfer can't be done in the wild just because you need repeated measurements and you actually need to get samples from the calf at a young age as well as the female repeatedly during lactation and gestation.
And so you are studying two whales at SeaWorld San Diego. Can you tell us a little bit about these two whales?
Yes. Yeah, so that is Kalia and her daughter, Amaya. Kalia, this is her first calf. Kalia was 10 years old when Amaya was born back in 2014. And so what I did, I didn't get the gestation for that animal because of the, I was just getting approvals from SeaWorld and such to collect samples. But I also do have another animal in San Antonio, a pregnant female named Takara. So we're actually getting gestation measurements on her now, and we'll get lactation when she has a calf. But as far as Kalia and Amaya, we collected blood from the mom about a month after the calf was born and milk. And we took those samples every 2 weeks for the first 16 months of lactation. And then we also took blood samples as we were able to from the calf. And we also were taking body mass and blubber thickness measurements to see how the blubber changes during this time as well.
So how long does a calf nurse in the wild and in captivity? And is it similar?
So it could be different, obviously. And, you know, it's really hard to see in the wild how long they're reliant on mom's milk alone versus mom's milk plus some fish. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the belief for sure is that they could nurse from their mom up to 2 or 3 years in the wild and are probably solely reliant on milk for the first year. And it's just hard to quantify how much they're getting from the milk versus the fish. So that's difficult. In captivity, obviously, these animals are exposed to fish a little earlier so they can be trained. However, for this female, I think the calf was pretty much relying on the mom's milk for most of the first year of life, and I was also provided with fish samples that were fed to the calf, as well as detailed information on how much, which in the grand scheme of things was very little fish during that first year.
And so I have to ask this. How do you get a milk sample from a killer whale?
So these animals are trained for all kinds of husbandry procedures, and they have taken milk from females before to analyze, you know, the nutritional content that their killer whales are getting. So they're trained, and they roll over and expose the ventral surface where their teats are, and it's kind of like a modified breast pump, just a hand-operated pump attached to kind of a syringe tube, and you just place it over the area where the teat is, and you just kind of pump, and I don't really take that much. I only take about 5 milliliters, which is a very small amount. And there are pictures on their website, I think, of it being done because they've done a story about this work on their own website as well.
And what type of killer whales, or what ecotype are they? Are they comparable to southern residents? I know in captivity, you know, things can get a little bit jumbled around, I guess.
Right. So there is a Orcapedia site or something like that on the web, and I'm not sure who does that or how accurate it is, but it sounds like Takara might be mostly Icelandic, and the mother, Kalia, from this study that's just been done collecting samples from the Kalia and Amaya, looks like Kalia might have some resident in her, but, you know, I don't know how accurate that is. But as far as whether or not it's a different ecotype, I don't expect that physiology of killer whales is really going to differ. Looking at terrestrial animals and contaminant transfer, it's really based on the physiology, the mammalian physiology, and the chemical structure of the contaminants. So even though I'm not studying a southern resident killer whale, I am studying a killer whale which would have the same basic physiology as a southern resident. And obviously the contaminant chemical structure, even though they have different contaminant amounts in the beginning, because of the different food they eat, you can report transfer on a proportion basis. You can still kind of get that number you need for proportion of load that's transferred from mom to calf.
And so what sort of contaminants do these SeaWorld whales have in their bodies, and how does it compare to our wild southern residents?
I haven't finished looking at the data, so I can't really talk about that, except for, I mean, obviously it does vary a little bit based on what they're eating. They are getting, I think, a lot of fish from Alaska, so they might even be more pristine than the southern residents.
But they're not eating salmon, are they?
They are given some salmon, Absolutely. They're given a mix of different fish, but salmon is definitely included.
Interesting. As I know, a lot of the time SeaWorld will say that they're giving their animals really high quality seafood, but I mean, it seems like any seafood that you get from anywhere is going to have some contaminants in it. Is that right?
Yeah, you can't avoid it. We're all contaminated. If you really want to check out some scary stuff, you can look at the human literature on milk transfer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we can't avoid it. But, I mean, they are getting fish from pretty decent areas. I don't think they're getting their samples from their I'm definitely... Well, I don't know where they get their fish from exactly, but, you know, I think they're not getting them from the Puget Sound.
Yeah, as a nursing mom, that does make me really worried. And I always, of course, try to watch what I eat, but sometimes as I'm snacking on, like, Skittles or something, I'm like, I wonder how this is going to affect things.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have three kids, nurse them all, too, and you got to think about that, but it's also what you have in your system, so it's... I think, you know, PCBs are just in the system. It doesn't matter if you eat organic or not, as far as those goes. You know, if it's in the water, if it's in the soil, it's pretty hard to escape having something in your system, which is really sad, but unfortunately the truth.
And I was reading, I think it was a technical memorandum or something, NOAA just released it by Teresa, and I was perusing through, it's very technical, but I'm a beginner at a lot of this stuff, but there was a table where it showed some of the contaminant transfer in gestation compared to during lactation.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like, I mean, just a huge difference between right. gestation and lactation, and there's just so much more being transferred during lactation, and that really surprised me.
Right. I can explain why. Actually, I'm a co-author on that, and I wrote that section.
Oh, so, thank you. Perfect.
So, yeah, and it's you'll notice that across species there's a wide range, and the reason why is because the contaminants that we're looking at are lipophilic. They bind to fat. They love fat. And so milk is high fat versus the blood, the nutrients are getting through the blood during gestation. And so that is why there's a higher amount that's supposedly transferred during lactation. But having said that, all these studies that have been done in the past for cetaceans have been done on dead animals. And they're not always the same mom. You can't really get a longitudinal across the whole duration with a dead one-time shot sample. So that's difficult to really get the full value, the actual correct value, because you have a one shot. You need a starting point and an ending point. So you need two samples from the same mom-calf pair, same mom-fetus, to actually get that information. And you can't get that the way that this these values have been reported, because that's just not going to happen in a dead-stranded animal. So what they're doing is they're going across different animals to try to get this information. And we already know from the biopsy work on lots of repeated biopsies and killer whales that have known number of calves, you know, whether or not they're born from mom, that they're firstborn or not firstborn, we see a different contaminant level based on that. So you can't really go across individuals to try to calculate how something is transferred, because individual starting point is going to be different. Individual contaminant levels are affected by the contaminants they had in their mom, their birth order, and all those things. So it's really tricky, and that table that is in that that tech memo is basically the current state of the knowledge, which is not great.
And it's a fascinating question, and it seems very complicated. How will your data and what you've learned from it be applied to back to wild killer whales?
So let's say well, if Teresa wants to repopulate her model and use the values that we're going to get from this study, then she could have a better idea of how to really move the time forward and try to project what contaminant levels might look like. The beauty of this study is that we're taking samples every 2 weeks, and we can get a handle on what the by taking the blood, we're not taking blubber, by the way. The blood, other studies have shown in animals that have been captured that the blood levels are indicative of what's in the blubber. So you can, so an animal that has a lot of levels in the blood is going to have a lot in the blubber. So that's how we're kind of taking the blood and able to really understand what's going on. So we know by taking these blood every 2 weeks, kind of, and the milk every 2 weeks, that's the actual shot of contaminants the calf is getting. It's through that milk. We can tell, you know, are we looking at, are animals subjected to higher levels when they're really young or later during lactation, or is it consistent over lactation? No one really knows that answer. And so we can actually have a better idea of when the young animals might be at most risk to receiving high levels of contaminants because we are measuring the levels in milk every 2 weeks during this whole lactation process. So that helps us understand an idea of understanding more for the calf risk when they're getting the most contaminant levels, and then hopefully maybe can help us understand more about calf loss.
So it could, we don't know if that first month of nursing, it has a lot of contaminants compared to maybe towards weaning time. Is that sort of what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Correct. I mean, I have done a study on Navy dolphins in the past, and we weren't able to collect as many samples, but we did see a definite change over the time in lactation that the levels in the milk do vary through time.
And so I know that you've done a lot of this work with captive whales. You've also done a little bit of work about vessel effects. And if you don't mind me asking you a couple questions about your research, it's sort of a hot topic right now with the new petition that NOAA received to add a whale protection zone to the west side of San Juan Island. What has your research shown about vessels, and what can you share with us?
Well, yeah, I haven't done a lot of vessel work in a long time, but I've worked on with collaborators as well as my own work that I was a PI on to look at surface active behaviors that seem to increase when they're approached more closely by vessels. I worked with Marla Holtz on Marla Holtz's project that showed that these animals are actually vocalizing louder when noise is greater, and we link the noise to vessel numbers. And another paper that I was published in the last couple years was looking at where these animals are doing certain behaviors, such as foraging, travel, socializing. Obviously, they do them throughout the whole San Juan Island area, but there seems to be some hot spots for foraging, which tend to be on the southwest side of San Juan Island. So that's kind of the work that would be relevant. We've been doing some work now to try to really understand the energetic costs of some of these responses using trained dolphins to understand the costs of vocalizing louder or performing tail slaps.
And do we know anything about that, like just how many fish would be expended in speaking up? Do we have any idea?
So for speaking up, can't really give it for a killer whale right now because we measured bottlenose dolphins, but work we're currently doing is getting a better understanding on how to scale that size up to other animals, including killer whales, beaked whales, and harbor porpoise. That work is funded by ONR, I guess scaled down in the case of harbor porpoise. But modifying the level of sound production as far as like making the sound louder does incur a cost. However, the cost of producing sounds is fairly low. And depending on how, you know, if it's a moderate increase, it's not really going to cost a fish. It might be costing a little bit more. I think even though our results are not finished, it's still a work in progress. I think the take-home message I'm beginning to see from this is even tail slaps are cheap, and we have seen that tail slaps seem to be performed a lot more regularly than like breaching, for example, around close approaches. So All these little responses do incur a small energetic cost. It may not be a lot. What I think the bigger take-home message is with this increased sound level is not being able to really perform well when you're trying to use sound for foraging or coordinating group movements for foraging. And so I think that these little energetic costs are probably, in the grand scheme of things, not huge, but the bigger cost is a lack of foraging opportunities that may be happening when they're switching from travel to forage, or from forage to travel, as was shown by David Lisseau and Rob Williams and David Bain. So I think that is the biggest cost, really, is a lack of foraging. Or reduced foraging, I should say.
And for, you know, a typical day in the summertime on the southwest side of San Juan Island, what can you quantify that sort of loss in foraging opportunity? Is it like 50% reduced, or I mean, what's that like from a killer whale's perspective?
You know, it's something that I'm currently working on, and I don't think it's as great as 50%, but it's something that I will be talking about at ACS next in February.
Okay.
And obviously, what I'm doing is using other people's data and just modifying how long they're with vessels. You know, the daily, exposure to vessels varies. And so it will obviously depend on that. So the stuff that I'll be presenting in about a month is just a pretty crude estimate by varying just how many hours they're exposed to vessels and then looking at how much reduction. So that's all based on surface active behavior or surface behavior as well. So we're inferring foraging based on surface observations, which may or may not be 100% equal to what they're doing underwater and how they're affected underwater. Because, you know, they've obviously, people have seen them catch fish when they're in, quote, travel mode. So it's really is just a kind of an estimate and a rough attempt to try to quantify this this loss.
And the ACS meeting that you're referring to is the ACS, American Cetacean Society, Puget Sound Chapter meeting. They meet once a month at the Finney Neighborhood Center, and it's a great way for local people to learn more. And so I encourage everyone to join us at those lectures. And I have one last question. I kind of want to circle back around to your work with captive whales. And there are a lot of people out there who are very against SeaWorld. And how would you respond to some of those opinions?
It is such a complex topic. And I guess my take on it is regardless of how you feel about animals in captivity, I think that it's kind of in vain not to use the opportunities we might have to better understand physiology or help us understand risk factors associated with southern resident killer whales. I'm a physiologist, and a lot of the work I do is nearly impossible to conduct on free-ranging animals. And I know a lot of people don't think physiology is important, but it is actually coming to light that physiology is really important for understanding limitations of animals. People are using physiology to understand limitations of animals with in relation to sea ice change. I think physiology is the mechanism by which animals start having a difficult time living in their environment. And much of the information we know about physiology, particularly whales and dolphins, much of it was learned in a situation where there were captive animals just because of the methods that are used. They're free swimming. They never come on shore like the pinnipeds do. So I think, you know, I have no problems working with SeaWorld because they've been very open, and there's other studies that we can do with their animals to help us understand health of killer whales, exactly, like, such as body condition. How do you determine if an animal that's stranded is in good body condition or not? So they're talking about how they can help with that too. So it's so complex, and people are entitled to their own opinions for sure, but I'm just saying that there is a good opportunity while they're there, they're not going to be released. We might as well learn what we can to try to help the wild populations.
And are you hoping to continue this work in the future and add other experiments?
As far as the transfer of contaminants, because they're no longer breeding the whales, the female that's pregnant right now will be the last and the second and the last in this study. However, as a physiologist and as someone that works for NOAA and realizing that one of the aspects of the southern resident killer whales that we're really having are struggling with is trying to address health, I am trying to think of other ways that maybe we could get measurements or better understand physiological processes that are helpful to how we better understand the risks associated with the southern residents. So there are some things that I've been talking to them about that I'm hoping that we could learn from the whales while they're there, that we can get some information that would be helpful.
Well, I thank you very much for doing this research and sharing it with us. And I hope to talk to you again in the near future.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks again for listening, everybody. And just as a reminder, this weekend, January 28th, 2017, we have a Whale Scout Helping Out event at Idlewood Park. It's in Redmond, Washington. Please look at our website for more details. It's from 9 a.m. to noon, and it's sure to be a lot of fun. And I always want to remind everybody that if you really want to protect these whales, the habitat right at our own feet is right where we need to start. And so please come out with us and make a difference. Also, if you like this podcast, go up to our website. We have dozens more going back in the previous couple years at whalescout.org, or go to iTunes and hit subscribe, and they will be automatically downloaded to your phone when we post a new one. Thank you very much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information.
Malatif est trop bien démodé, aussi mal coiffé que rasé, j'entretiens ma gueule négligée.